Good morning. KPCW News Time is 8:06 on this Friday, July 5th. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Bill Skinner, your host this morning. And it looks like we're in for a few more days of this beautiful weather here in the Wasatch Back. And with a look at this weekend's forecast, maybe even to tell us if there's a raindrop anywhere in our future, it's ABC4 Weather Center meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Bill. Yeah, good morning, Park City, Heber, Wasatch Back. We are looking at really nice weather, as you mentioned, for the next few days. Temperatures climbing back closer to seasonal averages as high pressure is starting to really inch over the state. So sunshine today, tomorrow, and on Sunday. Temperatures should be hovering right near 80 degrees all the next 3 days. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. High pressure is going to keep us dry, unfortunately. I don't see any rain in store through middle and latter half of next week. Just climbing temperatures as high pressure really takes hold and drives our temperatures up into the 90s, even for Park City. So after the low 80s through Sunday, we'll be mid-80s on Monday. 85 is expected, and 89 on Tuesday. Then we're in the low 90s on Wednesday, Thursday for next week. So you can imagine Heber City is also dealing with similar conditions, even hotter temperatures, 87 today. We'll see 89 on Saturday with similar temperatures on Sunday, into the 90s on Monday. 93 is expected. Overnight lows in the upper 40s. Should be in the mid to low 50s for overnight lows into middle of next week with temperatures approaching 100 degrees for Heber. In fact, 98 is expected Wednesday, 99 on Thursday next week. And it looks like it's going to hang on possibly even into next weekend. So I wouldn't be surprised if we have some heat warnings issued to next week. We already have some down in southern Utah where temperatures are approaching record highs next week as well.
All right. Well, thank you, Nate. I guess we'll enjoy it while we can.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, you have a great weekend.
You too. Right.
Bye-bye. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, Howard Sorensen, co-founder of South Summit Trails Foundation, is going to talk with Connor Thomas about the Weber Pathway Trail, which would connect Pioa to the Uintas. Then Parker Malatesta is going to visit with the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City to learn more about this summer's weather trends. And Jeffrey Howery, co-founder of the Park City rock band Dr. Bob, is going to chat with Connor Thomas, and he announces their first show here in town in 2 years. That's all coming up. Well, members of the nonprofit Save People, Save Wildlife are busy this holiday period to protest for safer animal crossings on State Route 224 here in Park City. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Save People, Save Wildlife is protesting in front of the McPolin Barn during the July 4th holiday to call for greater action to protect animals along the busy road that runs between Park City and I-80. A 2019 Utah Department of Transportation study ranked State Route 224 as the fifth worst road in Utah for vehicle wildlife collisions. A 2022 UDOT study found that there were 4 collisions per mile each year between vehicles and wildlife on SR 224. Lorelei Combs was one Save People, Save Wildlife member protesting near car traffic Wednesday morning. The group held signs calling out Park City Mayor Nan Worrell for the lack of progress to create a safe wildlife crossing.
We presented close to 1,000 letters to the city council from the public requesting safe passage for SR 224, and we've raised over $240,000 of donations for safe passage for 224, and they returned our letters, and quite frankly, we don't know if they were even read, and they never even, and specifically Nan Worrell, never even addressed the public.
City officials dispute the assertion that they didn't hear the group out, but wouldn't comment further Wednesday. Ultimately, UDOT controls the funding and design of the state road, and any wildlife crossing falls on its approval. Save People, Save Wildlife has long lobbied UDOT to take action. But UDOT spokesman John Gleason says a crossing on SR 224 just doesn't make practical sense to the agency. Gleason made the comments during a KPCW Local News Hour interview in April.
This is not a traditional migratory path for the animals. And so if we were able to build a crossing, essentially you'd just be transporting those animals into a neighborhood and they wouldn't have anywhere else to go.
Gleason says they are making smaller changes to reduce the risk of vehicle wildlife collisions.
Reducing the speed limit, putting in more signs to draw drivers' attention to the issue, and we're going to continue to look at other potential solutions as well, maybe even wildlife detection systems, more fencing.
UDOT reduced the speed on SR-224 from 55 miles per hour to 45 in 2022. Save People Save Wildlife has also been critical of High Valley Transit, which plans to widen SR-224 as part of its bus rapid transit project between Park City and Kimball Junction. High Valley Transit Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez also says slower speed limits and signs are best. Rodriguez says a wildlife crossing on SR-224 isn't supported by the agency's data. UDOT is pursuing a grant to help with a $30 million proposal that would add and refurbish wildlife crossings in Echo, where I-80 and I-84 meet. The Federal Highway Administration has millions of dollars of funding available for wildlife crossings as part of the bipartisan infrastructure law passed by Congress in 2021. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In 2022, Wasatch County voters approved a 0.1% sales tax to improve the region's trails, arts, and parks. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the first grants have been awarded.
The county will fund 13 different projects in its first round of Trails, Arts, and Parks, or TAP, grants. TAP Tax Advisory Board Chair Elise Overly told the Wasatch County Council the board was able to give over $285,000 to applicants. Grant awardees include the Wasatch Trails Foundation, Timpanogos Valley Theater, Charitable Acts Theater, Wasatch County Parks and Recreation, and more. Danny Hill, who runs the Homegrown Concert Series, won a grant to continue bringing year-round live music to the Wasatch County Library.
I really look forward to growing it, and the money will help me book artists. It'll help me promote the shows, get the equipment that I need to grow it.
Hill started the concert series a little over a year ago with support from the Wasatch County Arts Council. This summer, he's also planning outdoor concerts for Midway and shows at the Heber Market on Main. He says he values supporting local musicians and promoting live music for the community to enjoy. Overly says the board intends to set aside 10% of the tax revenue each year to build up a reserve.
We foresee larger grant applications coming in the future. Maybe larger projects or even more collaborative in nature.
Heber and Midway also receive a share of the TAP tax money and have their own process for awarding grants. The county's next grant cycle is in December. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And construction has not started on a new five-story parking garage at Canyons Village. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that's because the developer is revising its building plans.
Canyons Village master developer TCFC Finance originally planned to build in two phases. Two garage levels were set to open this winter, the rest in 2025. Now the company wants to build all five levels at once. Summit County's then top planning official, Community Development Director Pat Putt, approved the parking structure in the spring. It consolidates all of Canyons' existing parking on top of the Cabriolet lot, so the upper lots can be redeveloped. Putt says the planning department expected construction to have started by now, but TCFC returned to the drawing board after ditching its original two-phase plan.
Doing it all at once means those drawings have to be updated, the construction mitigation plan updated, and I know that they're feverishly working on that.
TCFC hasn't applied for a new building permit yet, and Laurel Simpson, the company's general counsel and development associate, declined to comment until it's submitted. The garage would have 1,800 parking spots, all of them covered, a four-lane drop-off area, and electric vehicle chargers. Simpson has said it will pull vehicles out of the village core and make Canyons more walkable. Later, TCFC would like to transform the space near the Cabriolet lift into a pedestrian plaza with new businesses. Putt expects the company to break ground in August. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Weber Pathway Trail is the vision of a few residents and local leaders in Oakley who want to connect Peoa to the Uintas with a single, continuous trail, 7 miles in all. That dream is slowly becoming a reality. KPCW's Connor Thomas checked in with one of the people organizing the trail effort, Howard Sorensen. He'll speak about an upcoming volunteer trail cleanup day, too, where the community can get a first look at the progress.
All right, and on the phone with me now is Howard Sorensen. He's the co-founder of South Summit Trails Foundation, which has been running for about 7 years here now. We're going to be talking about a volunteer cleanup day coming up and the Weber Pathway Trail more generally. Thanks for coming on the program, Howard.
Happy to be here with you, Connor.
All right, so as I mentioned, not this Saturday, but next Saturday the 13th, there's a volunteer cleanup day to kind of help forward some progress on the upcoming Weber Pathway Trail being built. For people maybe unfamiliar with the project, could you summarize what the vision of this trail network is?
Sure, that'd be great. This idea actually started 30 years ago, if you can believe it, with Doug Evans really making an attempt to make a trail system along the Weber River. It just wasn't the time for it to happen, it seemed like 30 years ago, and so it somewhat died. However, that is where the first conservation took place, up on Franson Lane, when Doug was working with the city council. He was able to preserve about 30 acres up there, and that's been a beautiful park that's been pretty much unknown to people for decades. We picked the idea up again about 7 years ago, and we being Doug Evans, myself, and Tom Smart, and we said, you know what? The Weber River is so congested, and when you get up into the canyon, and when you get even further down the river, that fishermen, children, people can't access the river. It's all private property, keep out. But we noticed right through Oakley, the ranchers had done an incredible job of not letting the river just be gobbled up and in development. So this became really as much an effort for a trail system. It became a conservation effort, quite frankly, and then to maybe connect it with trails. So over the past 7 years, we have worked tirelessly, just hundreds, if not thousands of hours, meeting with ranchers in their homes and talking about the value of the Weber River and the quality of the water that we all drink and just the beauty that exists there, and trying to conserve that. And that effort has really paid off to where we now have what we call a string of pearls that begins clear down on Wooden Shoe in Peoa with Marsh and Meadows, which is a couple of hundred acres that Summit Land Conservancy we brought in to work with us. And they did a beautiful job of conserving that entire ranch down there that will now be open to the public forevermore. Working up the river, we conserved another one with Summit Land Conservancy called Stevens Grove, which is up on Mill Race in Oakley. And then as you go up the river, we've got one called River Bend and Franson Lane. And the final string in the pearls, string of pearls, is the Oakley Trail Park, which is currently being doubled in size. And that is a multi-use hiker, horses, and bicycles, mountain bikes, I should say, trail system. That has different areas for horses and different areas for the mountain bikes that we're currently expanding into a much larger park. And from there, you can hop on the Oakley Trail system, the Oakley Trail that goes up the Hoyts Peak and onto the Uintas. So the overall vision is about a 7-mile corridor that will pass through the entire Weber River corridor up to the Uintas and then beyond.
Yeah, and so it's sort of a patchwork process, as you mentioned. With the cleanup day coming up on Saturday, which areas are you targeting? What's sort of the latest work to be done?
That's a great question, because like you say, this is an intermittent trail right now, so it's not a complete 7-mile trail, but rather sections that are beautiful, and we're working on connecting those as we go along, about 70% connected. The systems that we'll be working on are Stevens Grove. It had some pretty good flooding this year and just needs some pruning, and it'll be mainly weed eating and pruning. That comes off Mill Race and heads west towards Peoa. Then we'll also be doing a brand new stretch that was just completed last fall with three beautiful bridges that cross the Weber River and starts on New Lane headed eastbound and it connects up to this beautiful Franson Park. That one we have a lot of weed control we'll be working on, pruning, cutting back the grasses and what have you. And it's a great opportunity to come out and just see this beautiful new trail system and be a part of sprucing it up to where it's a joy to ride a horse, ride a bike, hike, whatever you, non-motorized. It's all non-motorized through the system. But again, it's multi-use. So we'll be focusing on those two main areas, Stevens Grove and New Lane up to Franson Lane.
Gotcha.
And a new park called River Bend that's at the other end of that.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, I guess a very good opportunity to see the work that's already been done. Do people need to bring any equipment on a cleanup day?
It would be fabulous if they had a pair of tree pruners, not the small pruners, but tree pruners, or a weed eater could be very, very useful just to cut back the grass on the sides of the trail. Those will be the main tools. And the South Summit Trails Foundation, we will have some of our trail tools available. But it's really helpful if they can bring those, one of those two items or both.
And the work that's been done so far, what kind of work is it? Could you describe what's gone into making the trail that you've, you know, got on the ground so far? Is it volunteers? Are you able to hire people? What's that been like?
We've had a mixture of things. Mountain Trails has been a wonderful partner in coming out and helping us once we have the conservations and right-of-ways. They've helped us build a fairly substantial amount of it. And then we've also hired professional trail builders. Right now, up on the eastern end of the mountain, Oakley Trail Park, we have a professional contractor that's doing about $350,000 worth of trail work up there, with a lot of it being for a mountain bike park for the youth and families in the area. So the work that has been done, a lot of the trail clearing, because you can imagine along the river bottoms, that is a lot of, you know, boy, clearing out trees and brush and what have you, getting it ready for a trail contractor to come in to actually build the trail. So there's been, I will say, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers hours to get the trail, rough trail prepared, followed by a professional trail builder that actually comes in and finishes the final product.
And I don't know if you have both these numbers, but do you know how many miles of trail you've laid so far, and, you know, how many acres are under a conservation easement in that string of pearls that you mentioned?
Yeah, there's still conservation going in progress in trying to conserve more of it, but we have conserved well over 200 acres of different parks heading up the river. And those parks have small trail systems within those. So to come out, say, for example, I know last winter we had a lot of cross-country skiers that would come into the different parks and just enjoy skiing through the parks in the winter. Same in the summer. You'll see horses. You'll see joggers. You'll see kids on their bikes. It's a variety of people. So the trails that have been established for a couple of years, they're in fabulous shape. Some of them are new trails, so they're just getting pounded down, and it won't be long till they're, and that's partly what the week from Saturday is all about, is to really prepare that so that it can evolve into a nice, it's just a single path, non-paved, beautiful pathway that follows the corridor up through the valley.
How much more do you think you can get done this summer before the snow falls, and do you have an ETA on when the whole pathway could get completed?
Well, the interesting part is the center of the pathway is probably going to be the last leg, would be my guess, because that passes through the heart of Oakley, where eventually there will be more development. It's just the way that, you know, all of these communities are seeing is pressure from new development, which is why this has been such a heritage project to try to get this done before that occurs. But I see by next spring, early summer, Summit Land Conservancy is connecting and really working on a new bridge down in Marchant Meadows and Peowa that will connect that up to the edge of the city center, Millrace. So that's going to be the western, I'll call it 3 miles, besides the trails that are within the park system down there. The northern part, I see that we're hoping to connect that probably by next summer, if not at least by the following summer. And then the center is really hard to know how quick that will be connected. If I were to put an estimate on it, 3 or 4 years before that's actually connected.
Definitely. So a long way off, but, you know, the parts that are completed, these are open to the public, right?
That's right. There's people that are just loving walking on the trails, riding on the trails, skiing on the trails, all of them.
What are some of the rules? You mentioned motorized vehicles are not allowed. Always a big topic of conversation are e-bikes, kind of a, you know, gray area. Have you written any explicit rules about that? What can you tell me about those conversations?
As of right now, we do not have any regulation on e-bikes. Obviously, we'd want to be very considerate with the throttle bikes that are very fast doing something down a trail like that. But thus far, e-bikes are using the trails, and we have not had any problems with them. So we, for the foreseeable future, don't see a regulation on that. We like people with pets to keep them on a leash, because, you know, Oakley is a very agricultural area. And this has taken a lot of really trying to make this a win-win situation for the ranchers, for the river, and for the public. And that's going to be very key, is people really having respect for each other, whether it's the e-bike and a horse or the dog on a leash with cattle across the fence. Or not only that, we have a lot of wildlife up this trail that would be deer and elk, and it's important they're not chased around by people's pets.
Yeah, and just once again, Saturday, July 13th is that cleanup day for those that want to help out this summer. Believe it's 9 a.m. to noon, and you're meeting just west of New Lane by the cell towers, right?
That's right. If you come to the north end of the rodeo grounds, there's some two very tall cell towers there, and there's a parking lot there. We put a pin in the announcement, if you happen to see that announcement anywhere, that you could drive to the pin. But if you get to Oakley, you can usually, especially if you get on New Lane, you'll see those cell towers, and that's where we'll be meeting, is that parking lot there.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add?
You know, I think people will just really love these trails as they get out to see them and see the benefits of both the conservation of the land that's taking place, as well as protecting the drinking water and the river for all the residents within the, not just Summit County, the state. You know how we rely on that river all the way to the Great Salt Lake, so.
All right. Well, thank you for your work. And we've been speaking with one of the founders of South Summit Trails Foundation, Howard Sorensen. Howard, thanks so much for being on Local News Hour.
That's great, Connor. Thanks for having me on.
Three organizations are in the running to receive a share of the largest grant ever awarded by the Park City Community Foundation's Women's Giving Fund. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more on next week's decision.
All of the nearly 2,200 members of the Women's Giving Fund can vote to decide which community group receives the top prize. This year, the group will give away three grants totaling $125,000. Park City Community Foundation Member Services Manager Rebecca Blanchette says the Grant Steering Committee received 22 applications this year and narrowed the field to three finalists. Of those, one will be awarded the high-impact grant of $75,000.
We have made videos with each of those finalists, and you can view those on our website at parkcitycf.org. And the three finalists are the People's Health Clinic, Mountain Mediation Center, and Summit Community Gardens and Eats.
If it wins, People's Health Clinic will provide reproductive care for uninsured community members, including family planning, contraception, as well as prenatal and postpartum care. The Mountain Mediation Center plans to provide low-income families with services to navigate housing stability and landlord-tenant mediation programs to prevent eviction and homelessness if it wins. And Summit Community Gardens would use the money to instill lifelong healthy eating habits and provide fresh fruits and vegetables to about 2,000 local school children through cooking, nutrition, and gardening programs. The deadline to vote is Monday, July 8th, and a grant award celebration is scheduled for Wednesday, July 10th at Red Pine Lodge. To be eligible to vote, Women's Giving Fund members must make a $1,000 gift to the grant fund. New members are eligible right away, even if they pay through a monthly recurring donation. Blanchette says members are encouraged to RSVP for next week's grant celebration.
We charge $25 per ticket, and that is helping to cover the cost of the event. Vail is an incredible sponsor of all of our work, and they sponsor most of that event. But as you know, the cost of labor and food have gone up, and so we don't want that to come out of the fund, and so we've just asked members to do $25. Open bar, great food. Good time.
The two runner-up organizations will each receive $25,000. For more information about Women's Giving Fund membership or to RSVP for the celebration, that's available online, kpcw.org. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
KPCW's Parker Malatesta spoke with the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City about summer trends and what meteorologists are watching this time of year. Here is that interview.
I am KPCW's Parker Malatesta. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm now joined over the phone by Christine Cruz. She's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City. How's it going today, Christine?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. So we kind of, you know, we do a lot of day-to-day weather here at KPCW, but we kind of wanted to take a step back with this interview and talk more broadly about the weather patterns that we're seeing in Utah this summer. And I just wanted to start with a basic question, Christine, kind of what specifically metrics are you all looking at the most throughout the summer? What, you know, kind of indexes or, you know, what are you really watching for the most during this time of year as compared to the winter?
So in the summer, one of the biggest things that we're always watching is what our fire weather season looks like. And one of the things that really impacts that is the development of the North American monsoon that generally will decrease our fire activity. So one of the big questions this year is, when will we see that North American monsoon response? And it's looking more and more likely. There's a few factors we look at, but it's looking more and more likely like we'll have a late and weak monsoon. So that could bring us an extended period of potential fire weather issues.
Yeah, and you know, I know another big thing, you know, it's in the national media a lot, and seems like we haven't had to deal with too much extreme heat compared to some other places. But in terms of the heat levels this summer, where are we kind of hitting at in terms of average, what are you guys kind of forecasting for the next several months?
It looks like the odds are favored towards above normal temperatures for the next few months, and in particular the next few weeks. It looks like it's going to be quite hot across Utah.
Yeah, and do you look at, you know, humidity, or are there other factors that contribute to the, you know, actual feeling of, you know, what the heat is on the ground? I forget that exact term, what that's called.
So one of the terms is heat index, and really when you're looking at heat, you're looking at whether people can recover at night for those people that don't have swamp coolers or air conditioners. If it stays really warm at night and we have day after day of hot temperatures, like looking at those near 100 temperatures, that is cumulative. So the longer a heat wave lasts, the longer we don't have that relief at night, the more impacts there will be to people that are exposed to the heat.
Yeah, and in recent history, how has, you know, when the heat waves have come, where have those low temperatures kind of hung around?
So in the Wasatch Front, we're looking at more like upper 70s, mid to upper 70s. Park City, I'm less familiar with the exact number, but you tend to have a little bit more recovery up there in Park City. It's more, those poor recoveries are more in the Wasatch Front and the urban corridor.
Yeah, and how does the general, are we dry here in Utah? I mean, I'm from the Midwest, and it's just incredible how dry and how much it helps my allergies. Can you kind of describe how the climate works up here?
Sure. So in the summer, if we don't have that response from that North American monsoon, we tend to be quite dry. And as we stay hot, we tend to continue to dry. So our humidities are much lower than where you're from in the Midwest. So it when you're sweating, you may not even notice you're sweating as much. And that's something also to keep in mind, is to make sure that you're drinking plenty of water if you're outside during these really hot temperatures, because you may not notice you're sweating a lot, but you're sweating a ton and you're losing all of that hydration.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to touch on is just, you see it out there a lot, and I just think we could use some more clarity. El Nino, La Nina, what are we in right now, and what does it mean?
So right now we're in what we call ENSO neutral, which means we're in neither a La Nina or an El Nino. We were in an El Nino pattern, and we look like there's a high likelihood we'll transition into a La Nina late this summer into this fall. Now for Utah, our impacts, we're kind of in the middle of where there's a lot of good signal, or you can say an El Nino tends to do this or tends to do that. We're kind of in the middle of those strong signals. So it can vary from El Nino to El Nino and from La Nina to La Nina what impacts we see.
Yeah. And I had saw that on the Weather Service social media pages for Salt Lake City, you guys had put out some warnings just recently about some high winds in particular areas of the state. What kind of extreme wind do we see, and where often is that?
In the summer, we tend not to see as much extreme wind because we are outside of the main storm track. It doesn't mean we can't, but we typically, when we're super hot, we typically go into more of a light wind pattern, if that makes sense, because those storms are either going too far to the north or far to the south of us.
Yeah, and when you say main storm track, what does that generally refer to?
So the jet stream is kind of what drives a lot of our storms, and that tends to lift north in the summer. And so then we end up in these areas of high pressure, these very hot temperatures over the Great Basin in Utah.
Yeah, and going back to heat, when we look forward, when can we expect the heat to peak here in the state, particularly, Wasatch Front, Wasatch Back area?
Do you mean for the whole summer or for this next heat wave?
Well, I guess we can start with that, the next heat wave. When can we expect it in the short term?
So depending on how you feel about heat, it looks like it's going to be extended. So the good slash bad news is that we may start to see relief by July 13th. So we're looking at that heat wave to develop early to midweek this coming week and just continue through the whole week. But we may see a little bit of relief by that Saturday, July 13th.
Yeah, and then taking a bigger step out, when do we normally see the maximum temperature of the year? When do those highest temperatures usually come in?
So that's another thing that depends on the development of the North American monsoon. Mm-hmm. And if we go with a late and weak North American monsoon response, our temperatures tend to peak in August. If we were able to summon that monsoon, sometimes they peak in July.
Yeah, and so I guess turning to water now, you know, we've had pretty solid winters the last 2 years. Just anecdotally, I feel like it hasn't rained too much here as of late. What do we see in terms of the rainfall, you know, just kind of currently and what we're expecting throughout the summer?
So right now, there's very little chance we'll see precipitation through that heat wave. And then as we get further out, it really does hinge on whether we can develop the North American monsoon. That's generally where we see our precipitation in July and August. There's sometimes we can get a storm in that storm track to manage to come through Utah. But it's going to really hinge on that development of that monsoon, whether we see much precipitation through early September.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible how much relies on the North American monsoon. When do you all expect to really have solid details on what conditions are going to be coming from that?
So what we watch is a combination of what the ENSO status is, that La Nina, because a earlier transition to La Nina would have helped us. It looks like that's not going to happen. We watch things like the sea surface temperatures in the Bay of California. So I think it's the Gulf of California, mm-hmm. Whether those are above normal. And that was the one positive signal towards a better North American monsoon. We look at things like what we call the Madden-Julian circulation to see whether that phases well for us and would help increase the number of eastern Pacific hurricanes. And that signal is not good this year either. So just a lot of these global patterns that have to come together to assist in the development of that monsoon.
No, that's fascinating. You know, those were kind of all the basic things I wanted to hit on, Christine, but anything else you want to mention in terms of what the National Weather Service is really evaluating this time of year?
No, I mean, there's a couple things that I think people need to be careful with the heat, making sure that they're not having heat illness. So if it's very hot outside, curtailing outdoor activities for, you know, the morning and the evening, making sure people are drinking plenty of water. With the 4th of July, this extended period since it's in the middle of the week, making sure that, you know, they're not doing things that are going to expose them or make heat illness worse. And then on top of that, when we do have critical fire weather conditions, what we call red flag warnings, making sure that you're being careful with ignition sources, like not parking on high grass, being careful with fireworks, and being really careful with campfires, and checking those fire restrictions and making sure that you're adhering to them. So those are the things that when we're going into a hot, dry summer that we really want to be careful of.
Yeah, and just, you know, we have a lot of very active people out here who like to be out on the trails. Is there, on these really hot days, maybe not defined extreme heat days for us, but is there a general barometer of how much people should be spending time outside?
I mean, the best guidance is when you're in those very, very hot days is to try to get your activities in the early morning before mm-hmm. noon, and then in the evening when things start to cool down, and to avoid that really hot period because it taxes your body. You dehydrate faster and you're much more prone to heat illness.
Okay, well, we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, Christine.
All right, let me know if you have any other questions.
Will do. Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
We've been speaking with Christine Cruz. She's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour.
Taking another look at some local news, Heber City is in the third year of a massive project to replace its aging water and sewer infrastructure. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports part of the project will have to wait due to inflation.
Since 2022, the city has been working to replace pipes that are more than 70 years old in some sections. But inflation pressures mean that the total cost of updating the lines on the city's east side has soared almost $11 million since the project began. That raises the price tag well above the $43 million budgeted for the work. The Heber City Council met Tuesday to vote on how to respond to the $10.8 million budget shortfall and approve a new construction contract. City engineer Russ Funk has been working on possible solutions with the contractors for 2 months. He presented three options to the council: to complete as much as possible with the original budget, to modify the project scope and spend about $2.3 million more than planned, or to find the money for the entire project. He recommended the intermediate option to avoid delaying some of the more needed repairs.
If we wanted to just do the absolute minimum, $43 million, basically we would eliminate 4th North and then the connecting box in between. The reason this 4th North is so important is because of how the project's been designed. That is the main sewer.
Councilmember Aaron Cheatwood asked about potential risks or higher future expenses if the city doesn't finish the repairs now.
Is there substantial or outsized risk of the lines that are in 300 North, 200 North, and those intersecting lines right now? Is there any higher risk than there was for the rest of the project?
Funk said the pipes do need to be replaced, but aren't at higher risk than anywhere else. He said the most critical infrastructure repairs have already been made. The City Council approved the modified plan for the current phase of construction. To cover the $2.3 million difference in cost, council members reallocated funds from elsewhere in the budget and from water and sewer fund surpluses. This phase of work will now cost a total of $9.8 million. Water and sewer replacements on 2nd and 3rd North have been put on hold for now. No timeline was set for budgeting or completing the delayed work. Funk estimates the modified construction project will be complete by July 2025. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And contractors will begin replacing aging bridges on Park City's section of the rail trail later this month. Starting Monday, July 15th, a detour route will be in place on the rail trail between Prospector and Richardson Flat Road due to the construction. The detour route, named the Wagon Trail, has gravel surface and will connect users to Richardson Flat Road, where the rail trail continues over 20 miles all the way to Echo. For bikers looking for a paved route to connect to Richardson Flat, the only option is to ride on the shoulder of State Route 248. Replacement of the bridges is expected to be complete by the end of September, and a map of the detour route can be found at kpcw.org. Well, Dr. Bob is one of Park City's oldest rock bands, but they haven't played a show in town in 2 years. Sunday, that's about to change. KPCW's Connor Thomas sat down with one of the band's founders, Jeffrey Howery, to talk about their upcoming show and the band's legacy.
All right, so I'm here with Jeffrey Howery. He's one of the founding members of Dr. Bob. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
So is it fair to call, I guess, Dr. Bob the longest running rock band in Park City at this point?
Dr. Bob, the band Dr. Bob, was started in 1982, 42 years ago. In my opinion, we are the longest running band outside of maybe the high school marching band or somebody like that. But we do have a little turbulence from a band called Block and Tackle Band. They are a longtime local band. They're working out of Heber now. And good friends of mine, great people, and they claim they started in late 1981 here in Park City. So I guess we're going to call it a tie between the Dr. Bob Band and the Block and Tackle Band. So hello to all my friends in Heber and Tommy Martinez and Joe Jeffs and everybody in the Block and Tackle Band, and it's a tie, Connor.
Sounds good. Well, I guess you've got a new sort of short film that showcases some of that more than 40-year history. Could you tell me a little bit about Dr. Bob Rocks?
Correct. We have a YouTube channel called Dr. Bob Band that's very easy to locate. Just go to YouTube and Google in Dr. Bob Band. We, in the last couple of years, with the help of our IT wizard, John Gonthier, we have put out, well, we started at the beginning of the pandemic. We switched over, started focusing on videos at the beginning of the pandemic. We now have 25 videos on our YouTube channel. The two most recent ones are the ones that we're hoping people might take the time to check out. One we just put out just 2 months ago is called Dr. Bob Rocks, and that shows the whole history of the band going back. Actually, there was a predecessor band. We started in 1977 at the University of Utah. Several friends of mine, I worked at the Chronicle, the University of Utah newspaper. I was the editor there in the late 70s. So several of my associates on the Chronicle staff, we put together a band called the Barney Fife Band, and that started in 1977. So I played my first gigs in Park City in 1977, way before Dr. Bob started. But I didn't live here until 1982, 42 years ago, and that year we started the Dr. Bob Band.
So
and that is documented in the Dr. Bob Rocks video.
How'd you settle on the name Dr. Bob? I know you've gone through a couple names there.
You know, there's one of the downsides of being in a bar band is you conduct all your business in an alcohol-drenched environment, and I'm going to plead the fifth on that. I think that story has been lost to years and years of alcohol abuse. So
okay.
We're not quite sure how that happened.
So the Dr.
One
Bob
thing
Rocks,
I would say, though, I do get occasionally approached by AA people, Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob was one of the two founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's sometimes at gigs I get people coming up to me, oh, this is an AA band. And I have to say, no, this is not an AA band. And I didn't realize Dr. Bob was a founder of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time of the founding. So that is not why we call it Dr. Bob.
Not that type of band yet.
Well, we're heading that way, Connor, but probably not there yet.
So the documentary's got a lot of great photos and sounds from the band's history. Could you talk about that sort of archival process and how you put all those different things together?
Well, the one thing the Dr. Bob Band did correct in our 42-year drunken stupor here in town is we always went to the recording studios over and over again. We now have 11 albums of all original music in release. And those are available on our website, which I think if you just Google in Dr. Bob Park City, you'll get to the website. So we have 11 albums. We have a huge backlog of material. So the whole point of doing the YouTube videos is we're trying to get our entire catalog eventually onto the platform of YouTube. So, that's one of the go-to places people listen to music, and it's free. So anyway, all the videos are an excuse, an outlet, to bring songs out of the vault, deep cuts. So this most recent one we did has 5 songs from various albums in the past. The photos were a real heavy lift to get that together after 40 years. It took a lot of work. It took me about 6 months to get the photos together for the documentary. We call it a rockumentary because there's no voiceover. It's just the pictures with a minimum of text. So it's kind of in a unique format. And so anyway, your question being, we've got tons and tons of backlog material, photos, albums, videos. We've got so much stuff that I can't even keep track of anymore. So each video is an excuse to get another song onto YouTube. And we now have 25. We've got probably 80 good songs and 80 songs that I hope nobody ever hears. So the 80 good songs, I'm trying to get on YouTube eventually, and that is the goal.
And it seems like it might last forever, provided YouTube lasts forever. I mean, could you talk about
why?
Just,
we were speaking previously off the air. Dr. Bob was started in 1982, shortly after Blair Fulner and his buddies started KPCW. So now I'm in a contest to see if I last longer than KPCW, which I think I will.
All right.
But as far as outlasting YouTube, I'm not so sure.
Okay. Well, could you talk about why it's important to preserve that history? And, why not just leave stuff in the vault and leave it for you and your friends? Why put it out there and preserve that part
of
history?
Well, first off, your assumption that I have friends might be going out on a little bit on a limb.
Okay.
Why is it important? Well, I often reference, I'm also a writer. Between 1979 and 1982, I was a writer and editor at Rolling Stone magazine in Manhattan, and I dropped out to do this. But I often reference Franz Kafka, the great existentialist, gothic horror writer. He was not published during his lifetime. He left instructions for his best friend to destroy all those great books like The Metamorphosis, The Trial, America. He told his friend, destroy these when I die, because he had no luck being published. So the importance to me is probably to leave a record. The beautiful thing about the digital realm is it doesn't seem to want to go away. I don't know what it would take to make it go away, but so if I'm never published or never really, you know, get a break in this lifetime, I think eventually my work will find an audience if it's left in the digital realm.
Gotcha. And can you talk about, you mentioned another video out there, Ghosts of Rock and Roll. Is that a similar sort of rockumentary format?
No, it's completely different. Those are the two videos we're pushing on our YouTube channel. The one previously mentioned, Dr. Bob Rocks, is the 20-minute rockumentary. Then 2 years ago, we played a 40th anniversary show at Deer Valley here in town. And we made an hour-long documentary film out of that, which is a live in-concert recording of the band. And that one is called The Ghosts of Rock and Roll. And that is also available on our YouTube channel. So those two are the two we're pushing. And, and it documents pretty well. Dr. Bob is an active, a big show band live. If it's the electric band, we do electric and acoustic shows. But when we play electric, it's a big show, and we wanted to document that. And so it's very well documented in this live concert film. It's an hour long. I sometimes tell people that they ask me to describe Dr. Bob. I tell them if the Osmonds started a band with Slipknot, you'd probably get a good idea of what Dr. Bob would be like. So you want to go and check out this movie. It's unlike any movie you'll ever see.
Was the Deer Valley show your last live local show?
The last time we played in town was 2 years ago, in July, right about this time at Deer Valley. We made that movie. We have not played in town for 2 years. And one of the reasons I'm here with you today, Connor, and let me just say thank you so much for allowing me to come on, and thanks to KPCW for allowing me to be here today. We have not played in town for 2 years. We have 4 shows booked in July coming up here, so it's a chance for people to come out and see a band that you don't get to see too often in town. And anyway, that was the last time we played. We made a movie out of it, so now we're back going to play again.
So the July shows, all 4 of them are in town. Could you kind of run through when people could maybe catch a song?
All 4 are in town. I don't want to confuse people today. The one show we're really pushing is Sunday, July 7th at the Quarry Village stage at Billy Blanco's out by in Quarry Village. For the uninitiated, you take the Jeremy Ranch exit off of I-80 and go west about an eighth of a mile, and you're right there. That is Sunday, July 7th, the Sunday of 4th July weekend. The other ones, I'd say watch the park record. They'll be in the music calendar there. My buddy Scotty Wasaki will get those in for you. But the one show we're pushing is coming up the week after this, Sunday, July 7th, Quarry Village, Billy Blanco's, 6 p.m.
Is the full band going to be there?
July 7th, yeah. We have an awesome band. Me, I'll be on vocals and guitar. We have the original drummer from the Gamma Rays, who was the best punk band ever to come out of Salt Lake City. Tony Korologos will be on drums. On bass, we have Clay Gustin, who's one of the best musicians to ever come out of Heber City, now lives in Salt Lake. He's on bass. And on harmonica, we have 3-term former mayor Dana Williams will be playing harmonica with us. That is Sunday, July 7th. And we strongly urge, I'd like to invite everybody out by the Quarry Village area, Pinebrook, Timberline, Summit Park, Jeremy, Hidden Cove, all those areas out there, New Park.
Do you need tickets? Is it free?
No, it's free.
Okay.
Dr. Bob is always free. There's nothing for sale at our website. We're old hippies. We're not in this for the for the money. We're in it for the music. We're not trying to sell anybody anything.
So how do you play shows now? Do you tour? Do you go places? Is this your first show in 2 years, period? You mentioned it was your first one in two years in town.
Well, like I said, I've been doing this. I started playing the guitar in 1964 when I was 9 years old. I was living with my family in Mount Vernon, Illinois. In 1969, I played my first paying gig. I personally have played about 3,000 shows since 1969. So I've, you know, been doing this for a long, long time. These days, live, like I said, when the pandemic started, we've switched over to videos. We've been getting a great reaction on YouTube. I haven't been playing live that much in recent years, but it's a long, long career. Over the years, Dr. Bob has opened for the Ramones, the Doobie Brothers, Huey Lewis and the News. Who am I leaving out? The Romantics. You know, we have, in the old days, we used to tour. I started the band with a woman named Betsy Connor Pott, who was her band for the first 20 years. She now lives in Portland. She has her own bands in Portland, doing very well. But we used to tour throughout the West, Pocatello, Butte, Sun Valley, Jackson, Wendover, you know, all the big stops. So over the years, we used to tour. I'm not touring these days.
All right. And again, that show is Sunday,
July
7th.
Right.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Jeffrey Howery, founding member of Dr. Bob. Thank you so much for coming on, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Connor.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour.